Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the September 26th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Whether or not it was a mere coincidence that the appearance of controversial ads on New York City buses inferring that Muslims are savages came on the heels of worldwide protests by Muslims over a shoddily made YouTube film depicting Muhammad as subhuman, one could only speculate. But given the known connections between the filmmaker, a convicted Coptic Christian Egyptian American con man, and the author of the ads, an American Jewish woman, Pamela Geller, who won the right to place them on public buses through a court victory in San Francisco, it is more than likely. The ads placed by Geller carry the admonition, quote, "In any war between the civilized man and the savage, support the civilized man," end quote. And below that, "Support Israel, defeat jihad." Geller, like Republican vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan, is a devotee of Ayn Rand, who in 1979 responded to a question by Phil Donahue on The Donahue Show about the Israel-Arab conflict by saying, quote, "If you mean whose side should we be on, Israel or the Arabs, I would certainly say Israel because it's the advanced, technological, civilized country amidst a group of almost totally primitive savages," end quote. Geller at first attempted to place the ads on the San Francisco buses, and after being turned down, she took the case to court and as a First Amendment issue and had the decision overturned. The U.S. is virtually alone among its allies, with Israel being a notable exception, and does not have laws prohibiting hate speech, which the ads clearly are, but I sincerely doubt that the First Amendment would protect anyone who wished to place ads on any city's buses that attack Jews or Christians collectively in a similar manner. But as the New York Times' Bill Keller pointed out in Monday's paper, Islamophobia is, quote, "the closest thing we have to a socially accepted form of bigotry," end quote. Without acknowledging the damage that such bigotry has done to American Muslims themselves or to those victimized by the U.S. in the Middle East, Southwest Asia, and Africa, Keller notes that, quote, "the rants of the bigots feed the anti-American opportunist," end quote. At about 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Professor Stephen Sheehy, a professor of Arabic and Arab culture at the University of South Carolina, whose 2011 book, Islamophobia, the Ideological Campaign Against Muslims, puts the widespread phenomena in a comprehensive perspective. Islamophobia has been on display in some numbers this week in New York with a gathering of the UN General Assembly and the respective speeches to that body by Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tomorrow, and President Obama yesterday. Obama has been publicly pestered by Netanyahu and his chicken hawk surrogates in the Washington think tanks and the U.S. media to publicly announce the red lines that Iran cannot cross without drawing an American attack. Although criticized at home for intruding into the U.S. presidential race, Netanyahu was allowed to appear as a guest on Meet the Press and CNN, where he repeated his demands, comparing Iran to an opposing football team and his red line to the goal line. He implied that Iran would cross that line soon, although he's been saying that since 1995. Quote, "You know they're in the last 20 yards, and you can't let them cross that goal line," Netanyahu told the NBC's David Gregory. "You can't let them score a touchdown because that would have unbelievable consequences, grievous consequences, for the peace and security of us all the world, really," end quote. While not bending over that far to please the Israeli premier and his critics, Obama told the General Assembly, quote, "Make no mistake, a nuclear-armed Iran is not a challenge that can be contained. It would threaten the elimination of Israel, security of Gulf nations, and the stability of the global economy," end quote. And that's why the United States will do what we must to prevent Iran, from obtaining a nuclear weapon, end quote. Early Saturday, before adjourning, the Senate had approved by a 90-1 vote a non-binding resolution that said essentially the same thing, that containment of a nuclear-capable Iran is not an option. Even though the resolution specifically states that it should not be interpreted as an authorization for the use of military force or a declaration of war, Senator Rand Paul claimed that it did and was the sole vote against the measure. Obama, as you've probably heard by now, had been heavily criticized by the Israel Firsters for not agreeing to meet with Netanyahu while both were at the UN, a decision that was announced by the White House after Netanyahu had said that, quote, "Those in the international community who refuse to put deadlines in front of Iran do not have the moral right to put a red light before Israel," end quote. Presumably, Netanyahu believes he has the moral right to tell the U.S. president what to do. Only Senator Barbara Boxer, whose pro-Israel credentials are impeccable, if such a thing could be said to be impeccable, had the guts or wisdom to publicly challenge Netanyahu's statement in the entire U.S. Congress. Since you have probably heard more than once by now Obama's comments on the video and the killing of the four Americans, including Ambassador Christopher Stevens in Benghazi, I will spare you that. While there continues to be speculation as to what group carried out what appeared to be a well-planned attack on the U.S. consulate, which may have had nothing to do with the offending video, the most off-the-wall conclusion as to who are the perpetrators belongs to Mark Robertson and Finian Cunningham of the Global Research website, who claim that the attack was carried out by Gaddafi loyalists who compose what the writers refer to as the Green Resistance. Robertson and Cunningham also claim that Libya is NATO-occupied territory, that, quote, "Al-Qaeda has been a group of mercenaries employed by Washington and London since 1980, and shamelessly illustrating their ignorance and insulting their readers' intelligence, the writers declare that the Taliban no longer exists." While there's no doubt that the agenda of Al-Qaeda and the U.S. and Britain have coincided for their mutual benefit on occasion, the notion that Arab fighters who have fought, killed, and died under its mantle are simply paid hirelings of Washington or London is paternalistic at best and racist at its worst. And members of the so-called left are often as guilty of that as the right. The Taliban, perhaps responding to the report of their extinction by Global Research, appears to be very much alive. What was described in the New York Times as, quote, "an audacious Taliban attack 2 weeks ago on a heavily fortified base in southern Afghanistan destroyed or severely damaged 8 U.S. attack jets. It was the most destructive single strike on Western materiel in the 11-year war. While other attacks have caused greater loss of life, the assault at Camp Bastion in Helmand Province, one of the largest and best defended posts in Afghanistan, or supposedly it was troubling to NATO because the attackers were able to penetrate the base, killing 2 Marines and causing more than $200 million in damage. We're saying it's a very sophisticated attack," said a military official there. "We've lost aircraft in battle, but nothing like this. 6 of the jets, which cost between $23 million and $30 million when they were first acquired by the Navy, were completely destroyed, and 2 more were so severely damaged it was unlikely they could be repaired. Also badly damaged were 3 refueling stations and 3 soft-skin aircraft hangars," the military said in a news release. NATO officials said the attack was conducted by 3 tightly choreographed teams of militants wearing American Army uniforms and served as a reminder that the Taliban remained capable of serious assaults despite the surge offensive against them. With the offensive over, nearly 10,000 American Marines no longer in Helmand Province, it has once again become a stronghold for the Taliban. Meanwhile, with the shutting down of joint patrols between Afghan and U.S. soldiers and Afghan and British soldiers after more than 50 fatal what they call green-on-blue attacks by Afghans on their Western counterparts, U.S.-NATO operations appear to be in shambles. The future of American involvement in the country was aptly described by historian Pankaj Mishra in a New York Times op-ed on Monday. Mishra pointed out that, quote, "the obsession with radical Islam misses a more meaningful analogy for the current state of affairs in the Middle East and Afghanistan. Quote, the helicopters hovering above the roof of the American embassy in Saigon in 1975 as North Vietnamese tanks entered the city," end quote. Mishra's article is entitled, quote, "America's Inevitable Retreat from the Middle East," and I hope to have him as a guest on a future program. On the Israeli-Palestinian front, which in terms of negotiations has been, quote, unquote, all quiet for months, even as Israel has continued expanding its settlements and destroying Palestinian homes and killing Palestinians. Haaretz American correspondent Hemi Shalev reported yesterday that, quote, Harvard jurist and well-known Israel advocate Professor Alan Dershowitz has secured Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's agreement to a settlement freeze formula that he hopes will break the diplomatic stalemate and lead to a resumption of peace talks between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. According to Dershowitz and other participants in a Monday night meeting with Abbas in New York, the Palestinian president also promised to make a, quote, a positive statement about the connection between Israel and the Jewish people during his Thursday address to the United Nations General Assembly. According to Shalev, quote, sources at the meeting also revealed that Abbas has assured U.S. President Obama's administration that he would not press for General Assembly vote on the Palestinian request for non-state recognition before the upcoming November 6 presidential elections. They also said that Abbas had asked Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to stop referring to, quote-unquote, wiping Israel off the map and to replace that incendiary formulation with a call to put Palestine on the map instead. Emerging from the meeting, Dershowitz told Haaretz that he came away from his discussion with Abbas convinced that, quote, if Abbas and Bibi Netanyahu sit down and have serious talks, they will find their positions much closer than is widely believed, end quote. Former U.S. Congressman Robert Wexler, who is president of the S. Daniel Abraham Center for Middle East Peace, who also took part in the New York meeting, agreed with Dershowitz and said that participants in the meeting came away with the impression that, quote, the actual differences on core issues are not that great. They are not insurmountable, end quote. In the meeting, Dershowitz reportedly secured Abbas's confirmation in writing to a sequential resumption of talks that may come to be known as, quote, the Dershowitz formula, first published by the Harvard jurist in a June 3, 2012 article in the Wall Street Journal. The formula states that, quote, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu should now offer a conditional freeze. Israel will stop all settlement building in the West Bank as soon as the Palestinian Authority sits down at the bargaining table, and the freeze will continue as long as the talks continue in good faith. Dershowitz, who said that he views himself as someone who can serve as an honest broker between Israel and the Palestinians, told Haaretz Shalev that he hopes the new formula will be able to break the stalemate that has prevented the resumption of peace talks by allowing Israel to view Abbas as having come to peace talks without preconditions while enabling Abbas to proceed. There are many things wrong with this article, not the least of which is the notion that Dershowitz, one of Israel's leading American attack dogs and the author of The Case for Israel, could or would act as an honest broker between Israel and the Palestinians. It's ludicrous. And that he says so publicly is the height of chutzpah, which happens to be the title of another one of his books. This is the same Alan Dershowitz who called his old friend, South African jurist Richard Gladstone, a traitor to the Jewish people, after the UN Commission, headed by Goldstone, determined that Israel has committed war crimes in its assault on Gaza in December 2008 and January 2009. And of course, there are preconditions. Whatever the size of the Palestinian entity, it would have no army or air force. Israel would have access to the Palestinian airspace. Israel would maintain its major settlement blocks, plus the Jordan Valley, which it has steadily ethnically cleansed since 1967. And there would be no right of return for Palestinians and their families who were expelled from their homes and villages in 1948. Abbas, of course, has no business negotiating with Israel in the first place, since his term of office expired in January 2009 and there's been no elections held since. He has been kept in power by Israel and a U.S.-trained and armed militia whose job has been not to protect the Palestinian people of the West Bank against Israeli incursions and depredations, but to protect Israel against Palestinian resistance. In truth, the whole thing is a farce. The peace process has just been used as a cover for the expansion of Jewish settlements on the West Bank and the continuation of the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians that began in 1948. And there is no war that requires peace. Essentially, despite the Second Intifada, it was over when Yasser Arafat signed the Oslo Agreement in 1993. Moreover, since Israel has been getting everything it wants from the U.S. as well as from Europe, while the settlements continue to grow, there is no reason to even go through the charade of negotiations.